8.
Land ho! Cried the early evening foremast watch. Land and fire! 1 point on the starboard bow!
Fire? Locke looked up from his hand in the card game that had broken out in the undercastle.
Shit!
He dropped his cards to the deck, forfeiting his 7 solari bet for the round. Nearly a year's pay for an honest Ferrari labourer. Common stakes for the games that took place after shares were paid out. There was a lot of spare coinage floating around the ship since they'd left Port Prodigal in such a hurry. Emerging from the undercastle, he nearly slammed into Del Mastro.
Lieutenant, is that Talvarar?
Has to be.
And the fire? Is that certain?
Fire in the city could mean some sort of disaster, or it could mean civil war. Chaos. Stragos might already be dead, or besieged, or even victorious, and therefore in no further need of Locke or Jean.
It's the 21st, Ravel.
I know what bloody day it is, I just...
Oh.
Oh!
The 21st of Orim, the Festa Iono, the grand pageant of the Lord of the Grasping Waters. Locke sighed with relief. Away from the usual rhythms of the city, he'd all but forgotten about the holiday. At the Festa Iono, the Ferrari gave thanks for Iono's influence on the city's fortunes by ceremonially burning old ships, while thousands of drunkards made a mess of the streets and canals. Locke had only ever seen it from the balconies of the Sinspire, but it was a lively time. Hell, that would make slipping into the city easier. There'd be 1,000 things going on to keep the watch busy.
All hands! Came the cry from astern. All hands at the waist! Captain wants a word!
Locke grinned. In the event of an all-hands call during a card game, the game had to stop, and everyone with a stake in the pot got it back. His 7 solari would be returning home soon enough. The orchids mustered noisily at the waist, and after a few minutes were waved to silence by Dracascia. The captain set an empty cask beside the mainmast, and Lieutenant Del Mastro leapt atop it, wearing a respectable overcoat from the ship's store of fine clothing.
"For the rest of the night," she shouted, "wear the Chimera! And we've never even heard of the poison orchid. I'm the captain. I'll be pacing the quarterdeck if anyone needs anything, and Dracascia will be in her cabin unless things go to hell. If another ship hails us, I'll be the one that answers. The rest of you pretend that you don't speak Therin. Our task is to deliver 2 of our new friends to shore for a job that'll be important to us all. Ravel, Valora, we'll send you out in the same boat you donated to our cause all those weeks ago."
She paused to allow a sudden outburst of chatter to die off.
"We should drop anchor in the next 2 hours. If you're not back by sunrise, this ship will be gone, and we'll never come within 500 miles of this city again."
"We understand," said Locke.
"Once the anchor's down," continued Del Mastro, "I'll want double watches aloft. Rig razor nets on both sides for a quick raise, but leave them down. Lay pole arms at the sides, up against the rails, and ready sabres at both the masts. If a customs boat or anything else carrying a uniform tries to pay us a visit, we'll invite them aboard and detain them for the night. If anything more than that troubles us, we repel boarders, lay on the canvas, and run like hell."
There was a general murmur of approval to that idea.
"That's it. Stand in to Tal Ferrar. Mum Chance, put us about 1 mile off the Emerald Galleries, and raise an Ashmere grey ensign at the taffrail."
Ashmere, though lacking a merchant or military fleet of its own, did a brisk business in registrations of convenience for smugglers, bounty privateers, and tariff-dodging merchants. Nobody would look twice at them for the sake of that ensign. More importantly, nobody would approach merely for the sake of making small talk with fellow countrymen far from home. Locke approved. And anchoring in the waters southeast of the city would give them a good approach to the Castellana, so they could drop in on Stragos without lurking too close to the crowded marinas or the main anchorage.
"Hey!"
said Utgar, slapping Locke and Jean on the backs.
You two, what the hell are you getting yourselves into? You want a bodyguard?
Ravel's the only bodyguard I need, said Jean with a smirk.
Fair enough, I'll give you that. But what are you sticking your noses into, hmm? Something dangerous?
Probably not, said Locke. Look, Drakasha will spin the full tale, probably sooner than you think. For tonight, let's just say we're on ordinary errands.
Saying hello to grandmother, said Jean. Paying off uncle's gambling debts, picking up 3 loaves of bread and a bushel of onions at the night market.
Fine, fine, keep your secrets. Rest of us'll stay behind and be bored, right?
Not likely, said Locke. This ship's full of little surprises, isn't it?
True enough, said Utgard, chuckling. True enough, hey. Well, be careful. Eyes of the gods upon you and all that.
Thanks. Locke scratched his beard and then snapped his fingers. Hell, I nearly forgot something. Jerome, Utgard, see you in a bit. He jogged aft, dodging blue watchwork parties and bored reds helping haul forth weapons from the arms lockers. He took the quarterdeck stairs in 2 quick leaps, slid down the companionway rails, and knocked loudly on Drakasha's cabin door.
It's open, she shouted.
Captain, said Locke, closing the door behind him, I need to borrow the money that was in my sea chest again. Drakasha was lounging on her hammock with Paolo and Cosetta, reading to them from a heavy book that looked an awful lot like a wise mariner's practical lexicon.
Technically, that money got cut up into shares, she said, but I can give you the equivalent out of the ship's purse.
All of it? 250 solari should do.
Oh, it, won't be coming back with me.
Fascinating, she said. That's a definition of borrow that doesn't exactly compel me to get up from this hammock. On your way out...
Captain, Stragos is just 1/2 of tonight's business. I need to keep Requin purring, too. He has the power to crush this scheme like an insect if I don't. Besides, if I tickle his fancy, there's one more useful item I might be able to squeeze out of him, now that I think of it.
So you need a bribe?
Between friends, we call them considerations. Come on, Drakasha, consider it an investment in our desired outcome.
For the sake of my peace and quiet, fine.
I'll have it waiting for you when you leave the ship.
You're too... I am not even remotely too kind. Be gone.
9. They'd been away for 7 weeks that felt like a lifetime. Standing at the larboard rail, staring once again at the islands and towers of Tal Varar, Locke felt anxiety and melancholy mingling like liquors. The clouds were low and dark above the city, reflecting the orange light of the festival fire burning in the main anchorage.
Ready for this? Asked Jean.
Ready and sweating heavily, said Locke. They were dressed in borrowed finery, linen caps and cloaks. The cloaks were too warm, but not so rare on the streets of many neighbourhoods. They meant that the wearer was probably carrying weapons, and not to be trifled with. Hopefully the added clothing would help protect them from a casual glimpse by anyone inconvenient who might recognise them.
Heave out!
Cried Oskar, in charge of the party, putting their boat over the side. With the creak of rope and tackle, the little craft swung out into darkness and splashed down into the water. Utgard shimmied down the boarding net to unfasten everything and prepare the oars. As Locke stepped to the entry port and prepared to go down, Del Mastro caught his arm.
Whatever else happens, she whispered, just bring him back.
I won't fail, said Locke. And neither will he.
Zamira said to give you this.
Del Mastro passed over a heavy leather purse packed tight with coins. Locke nodded his gratitude and slipped it into an inner cloak pocket. As Locke crawled down to the boat, he passed Utgard, who gave a cheery salute and kept climbing. Locke hopped down into the boat, but continued clinging to the boarding net so he could stand upright. He glanced up,
and by the light of the ship's lanterns he saw Jean and Ezri saying farewell with a kiss. She whispered something to him, and then they parted.
"This is infinitely preferable to the last time we shared this boat alone," said Jean as they settled onto the rowing bench and fit the oars to their locks.
"You told her your real name, didn't you?"
"What?" Jean's eyes grew wide, and then he scowled. "Is that a guess?"
"I'm not much of a lip-reader, but the last thing she said to you had one syllable, not two."
"Oh," sighed Jean. "Well, aren't you the clever little bastard?"
"Yes, on all three counts, actually."
"I did, and I'm not sorry."
"Gods, I'm not angry, Jean. I'm just showing off." They began to row together, pulling hard, driving the boat across the dark, choppy water toward the channel between the Galezzo district and the Emerald Galleries. Minutes of rowing passed without conversation. The oars creaked, the water splashed, and the poison orchid fell away to stern, the whiteness of her furled sails vanishing into the darkness, until all that remained of her was a faint constellation of lantern lights.
"The alchemist," said Locke, without any warning.
"Huh?"
"Stragos Alchemist. He's the key to this mess."
"If by key you mean cause."
"No, listen. How likely is it that Stragos is ever going to just accidentally leave us the glasses he uses to give us our antidote? Or let a dose slip out of his pocket?"
"Easy question," said Jean. "It's bloody impossible."
"Right. So it's no use waiting for him to make a mistake. We've got to make contact with that alchemist."
"He's one of the Archon's personal retinue," said Jean. "Maybe the most important person in Stragos' service, if Stragos makes a habit of doing this frequently. I doubt he has a nice, convenient, out-of-the-way house where we can pay him a visit. He probably lives at the Mon Magisteria."
"But there's got to be something we can do," said Locke. "The man has to have a price. Think of what we've got at the Sinspire, or what we could get with Drakasha's help."
"I'll admit it's the best idea yet," said Jean, "which isn't saying much."
"Eyes wide, ears open, and hope in the crooked warden," Locke muttered. On this side of the city, Tal Vahrar's inner harbour was thick with pleasure boats, barges, and hired gondolas. The wealthy, and the not-so-wealthy who didn't care whether or not they woke up without a sentira the next day, were in full migration from the professional crescents to the bars and coffee-houses of the Emerald Galleries. Locke and Jean slipped into the stream and rowed against the prevailing current, dodging larger vessels and exchanging choice vulgarities with the shouting, leering, bottle-throwing customers on some of the rowdier barges. Having dished out more abuse than they'd received, they slipped at last between the Artificer's Crescent and the Alchemist's Crescent, admiring the vivid blue and green fireballs that the alchemists were hurling, presumably in support of the Festa, though one never knew, 40 or 50 feet into the air over their private docks. The prevailing wind was toward Locke and Jean, and as they rowed they found themselves pursued by a brimstone-scented rain of sparks and burnt paper scraps. Their destination was easy enough to find. At the northwestern end of the Castellana lay the entrance grotto to the Elderglass caverns from which they'd emerged with Meraine, the first night she'd kidnapped them on the Archon's behalf. Security at the Archon's private landing had been enhanced. As Locke and Jean rowed around the final bend into the prismatic glass hollow, a dozen eyes hefted crossbows and knelt behind curved iron shields 5 feet high, set into the floor to provide cover. Behind them, a squad of regular Vahrari soldiers manned a ballista, a minor siege engine capable of shattering their boat with a 10-pound quarrel. An eye officer pulled a chain leading into a wall aperture, presumably ringing an alarm above.
"Use of this landing is forbidden," shouted the officer.
"Please listen carefully," shouted Locke. The dull roar of the waterfall high above echoed throughout the cavern, and there was no room for error. "We have a message for the waiting lady."
Their boat bumped up against the edge of the landing. It was disconcerting, thought Locke, having so many crossbows, large and small, dedicated to their intimidation.
However, the eye officer stepped over and knelt beside them. His voice echoed metallically through the speaking holes of his featureless mask.
"You're here on the waiting lady's business?"
"We are," said Locke. "Tell her precisely this. Two sparks were kindled and two bright fires returned."
"I shall," said the officer.
"In the meantime..."
After carefully setting their crossbows down, half a dozen eyes stepped out from behind their shields to haul Locke and Jean out of their boat. They were restrained and patted down. Their boot daggers were confiscated, along with Locke's bag of gold. An eye examined it and then passed it to the officer.
"Solari, sir. Confiscate it?"
"No," said the officer. "Take them to the waiting lady's chamber and give it back. If money alone could kill the protector, the priori would have already done it, eh?" 10.
"You did what to the red messenger?"
Maxillan Stragos was red-faced with wine, exertion, and surprise. The Archon was dressed more sumptuously than Locke had ever seen him, in a vertically striped cape of sea-green silk that alternated with cloth of gold strips over a coat and breeches that also gleamed gold. He wore rings on all 10 of his fingers, set alternately with rubies and sapphires, very close approximations of the Tal Varrar colours. He stood before Locke and Jean in a tapestry-walled chamber on the first floor of the Mon Magisteria, attended by a pair of eyes. If Locke and Jean had not been granted chairs, neither had they been trussed up, or placed in the sweltering chamber.
We used it to initiate successful contact with pirates.
By losing it to them?
In a word, yes.
And Caldris is dead?
For some time.
Now tell me, Lamora, just what sort of reaction were you hoping for when you brought me this news?
Well, a fucking heart attack would have been nice, but I'd settle for a bit of patience while I explain further.
Yes, said the Archon. Do.
When the messenger was taken by pirates, all of us aboard were made prisoners. Locke had decided that the specific details of injuries and scrub watches and so forth could be safely left out of the story.
By whom?
Drakasha.
Zamira lives, does she? With her old poison orchid?
Yes, said Locke. It's in fine condition, and in fact it's currently riding at anchor about 2 miles,
he pointed with a finger at what he believed to be south, that way.
She dares?
She's practicing an obscure technique called disguise, Stragos.
So you're part of her crew now?
Yes. Those of us taken from the messenger were given a chance to prove our intentions by storming the next prize Drakasha took. You won't see the messenger again, as it's been sold to a sort of, wrecker baron. But at least now we're in a position to give you what you want.
Are you?
The expression on Stragos' face went from annoyance to plain avarice in an eye blink.
How refreshing to hear you deliver such a report in lieu of vulgarity and complaint.
Vulgarity and complaint are my special talents, but listen. Drakasha has agreed to drum up the scare you want. If we get our antidote tonight, by the end of the week you'll have reports of raids at every point of the compass. It'll be like dropping a shark in a public bath.
What do you mean precisely by Drakasha has agreed?
Improvising a fictional motive for Zamira was elementary. Locke could have done it in his sleep.
I told her the truth, he said. The rest was easy. Obviously, once our job is done, you'll send your navy south to kick 16 shades of shit out of every Ghostwind pirate you find. Except the one that actually started the mess, who will conveniently hunt elsewhere for a few months. And once you've got your grand little war sewn up, she goes back home to find that her former rivals are on the bottom of the ocean. Alas.
I see, said Stragos.
I would have preferred not to have her aware of my actual intentions.
If there are any survivors in the Ghost Winds, said Locke, she can hardly speak of her role in the matter to them, can she? And if there are no survivors, who can she talk to at all?
Indeed, muttered Stragos. However, said Jean, if the two of us don't return quite soon, the Orchid will head for the open sea, and you'll lose your one chance to make use of her.
And I will have wasted the messenger, and poisoned my reputation, and endured the abuse of your company, all for nothing. Yes, Tannen, I'm well aware of the angles of what you no doubt believe to be a terribly clever argument.
Our antidote, then?
You've not earned a final cure yet, but you'll have the consequences further postponed.
Stragos pointed to one of the eyes, who bowed and left the room. He returned a few moments later and held the door open for two people. The first was Stragos' personal alchemist, carrying a domed silver serving tray. The second was Merain.
"Our two bright fires have returned," she said.
She was dressed in a long-sleeved gown that matched the sea-green portions of Stragos' cape, and her slender waist was accented by a tight cloth of gold sash. Threaded into her hair was a circlet of red and blue rose blossoms.
"Costa and the Ferrer have earned another temporary slip of life, my dear."
He held out his arm and she crossed over to him, taking his elbow in the light and friendly fashion of a chaperone rather than a lover.
"Have they now?"
"I'll tell you about it when we return to the gardens."
"Some sort of Festa Yono affair, Stragos? You've never struck me as the celebratory type," said Locke.
"For the sake of my officers," said Stragos. "If I throw galas for them, the priori spread rumours that I am profligate. If I do nothing, they whisper that I am austere and heartless. Regardless, my officers suffer far more in society when they have no private functions from which to exclude their jealous rivals. Thus I put my gardens to use, if nothing else."
"I weep again for your hardship," said Locke. "Forced by cruel circumstance to throw garden parties."
Stragos smiled thinly and gestured at his alchemist. The man swept the dome from the silver tray, revealing two white frosted crystal goblets full of familiar pale amber liquid.
"You may have your antidote in pear cider tonight," said the Archon, "for old time's sake."
"Oh, you funny old bastard." Locke passed a goblet to Jean, emptied his in several gulps, and then tossed it into the air.
"Heavens, I slipped!"
The crystal goblet struck the stone floor with a loud clang rather than a shattering explosion into fragments. It bounced once and rolled into a corner, completely unharmed.
"A little gift from the master alchemists."
Stragos looked extraordinarily amused.
"Hardly elderglass, but just the thing to deny rude guests their petty satisfactions."
Jean finished his own cider and set his glass back down on the bald man's serving tray. One of the eyes fetched the other goblet, and when they were both covered by the silver dome once again, Stragos dismissed his alchemist with a wave.
I
said Locke, but the man was already out the door.
"This evening's business is concluded," said Stragos. "Merain and I have a gala to return to. Costa and De Ferra, you have the most important part of your task ahead of you. Please me, and I may just yet make it worth your while."
Stragos led Merain to the door, turning only to speak to one of his eyes.
"Lock them in here for 10 minutes. After that, escort them back to their boat. Return their weapons and see that they're on their way. With haste."
But damn!"
Locke sputtered as the door slammed closed behind the two eyes.
"Antidote," said Jean. "That's all that matters for now. Antidote."
"I suppose." Locke put his head against one of the room's stone walls.
"Gods, I hope our visit to Requin goes more smoothly than this."
11.
Service entrance, you ignorant bastard!
The Sinspire bouncer came out of nowhere. He doubled Locke over his knee, knocking the wind out of him in one cruel slam, and hurled him back onto the gravel of the lantern-lit courtyard behind the tower. Locke hadn't even stepped inside, merely approached the door after failing to spot anyone he could easily bribe for an audience with Selendri.
Oof!
He said as the ground made his acquaintance. Jean, guided more by loyal reflex than clear thinking, got involved as the bouncer came forth to offer Locke further punishment. The bouncer growled and swung a too casual fist at Jean, who caught it in his right hand and then broke several of the bouncer's ribs with the heel of his left. Before Locke could say anything, Jean kicked the bouncer in the groin and swept his legs out from beneath him.
Urgh!
The man said as the ground made his acquaintance. The next attendant out the door had a knife. Jean broke the fist that held it and bounced the attendant off the Sinspire wall like a handball from a stone court surface. The next six or seven attendants who surrounded them, unfortunately, had short swords and crossbows.
"You have no idea who you're fucking with," said one of them.
"Actually,"
came a harsh feminine whisper from the service entrance,
"I suspect they do."
Selendri wore a blue and red silk evening gown that must have cost as much as a gilded carriage. Her ruined arm was covered by a sleeve that led down to her brass hand, while the fine muscles and smooth skin of her other arm were bare, accentuated by gold and elderglass bangles.
"We caught them trying to steal into the service entrance, mistress," said one of the attendants.
"You caught us getting near the service entrance, you dumb bastard!" Locke rose to his knees. "Selendri, we need to..."
"I'm sure you do," she said. "Let them go. I'll deal with them myself. Act as though nothing happened."
"But he... God, I think he broke my ribs!"
wheezed the first man Jean had dealt with. The other was unconscious.
"If you agree that nothing happened," said Selendri, "I'll have you taken to a physical. Did anything happen?"
No. No, mistress, nothing happened."
"Good."
As she turned to re-enter the service area, Locke stumbled to his feet, clutching his stomach, and reached out to grab her gently by the shoulder. She whirled on him.
"Selendri," he whispered. "We cannot be seen on the gaming floors. We have..." "Powerful individuals rather upset about your failure to give them a return engagement?"
She knocked his hand away.
"Forgive me. And yes, that's exactly it." "Durenna and Corvalur are on the fifth floor. You and I can take the climbing closet from the third."
"And Jerome?"
"Stay here in the service area, Valora."
She pulled them both in through the service entrance so tray-bearing attendants, studiously ignoring the injured men on the ground, could get on with earning festival night tips from the city's least inhibited.
"Thank you," said Jean, taking a half-hidden spot behind tall wooden racks full of unwashed dishes.
"I'll give instructions to ignore you," said Selendri. "As long as you ignore my people."
"I'll be a saint," said Jean.
Selendri grabbed a passing attendant with no serving tray and whispered a few terse instructions into his ear. Locke caught the words dog leech and dock their pay. Then he was following Selendri into the crowd on the ground floor, hunched over as though trying to shrink down beneath his cloak and cap, praying that the next and only person who'd recognize him would be Requin. 12.
7 weeks, said the master of the Sinspire. Selendri was so sure we'd never see you again.
3 weeks down and 3 weeks back, said Locke. Barely spent a week in Port Prodigal itself.
You certainly look as though you passed some time on deck, working for your berth.
Ordinary sailors attract much less notice than paying passengers.
I suppose they do. Is that your natural hair color?
I think so. Swap it as often as I have and you start to lose track.
The wide balcony doors on the eastern side of Requin's office were open, but for a fine mesh screen to keep out insects. Through it, Locke could see the torch-like pyres of two ships in the harbour, surrounded by hundreds of specks of lantern light that had to be spectators in smaller craft.
"They're burning four this year," said Requin, noticing that the view had caught Locke's attention. "One for each season. I think they're just finishing the third. The fourth should go up soon, and then all will be well. Fewer people in the streets and more crowding into the chance houses."
Locke nodded and turned to admire what Requin had done with the suite of chairs he'd had crafted for him. He tried to keep a smirk of glee off his face and managed to look only vaguely appreciative. The four replica chairs were placed around a thin-legged table in a matching style, holding bottles of wine and an artful flower arrangement.
"Is that a replica as well? I'm afraid so. Your gift spurred me to have it made."
"My gift? Speaking of which..." Locke reached beneath his cloak, removed the purse, and set it down atop Requin's desk.
"What's this?"
"A consideration," said Locke. "There are an awful lot of sailors in Port Prodigal with more coins than card cents." Requin opened the satchel and raised an eyebrow.
"Handsome," he said. "You really are trying very hard not to piss me off, aren't you?"
"I want my job," said Locke, "now more than ever."
"Let's discuss your task, then. Does this Carlo Callas still exist?"
"Yes," said Locke. "He's down there."
"Then why the hell didn't you bring him back with you?"
"He's out of his fucking mind," said Locke.
"Then he's useless."
"No, not useless. He feels persecuted, Requin. He's delusional. He imagines that the Priori and the Artificers have agents on every corner in Port Prodigal, every ship, every tavern. He barely leaves his house." Locke took pleasure at the speed with which he was conjuring an imaginary life for an imaginary man. "But what he does inside that house, what he has, locks, hundreds of them, clockwork devices, a private forge and bellows. He's as insatiable about his trade as he ever was. It's all he has left in the world."
"How is a madman's detritus significant?"
asked Selendri. She stood between two of Requin's exquisite oil paintings, leaning against the wall with her arms folded. "I experimented with all kinds of things back when I thought I might have a chance to crack this tower's vault. Acids, oils, abrasives, different types of picks and tools. I call myself a fair judge of mechanisms as well as lock-breaking. And the things this bastard can do, the things he builds and invents, even with a magpie mind..." Locke spread his hands and shrugged theatrically. "Gods!"
"What will it take to bring him here?"
"He wants protection," said Locke. "He's not averse to leaving Port Prodigal. Hell, he's eager to. But he imagines death at every step. He needs to feel that someone with power is reaching out to pull him under their cloak."
"Oh, you could just hit him over the head and haul him back in chains," said Selendri.
"And risk losing his actual cooperation forever? Worse, deal with him on a 3-week voyage after he wakes up. His mind is delicate as glass, Selendri. I wouldn't recommend knocking it around." Locke cracked his knuckles. Time to sweeten the pitch. "Look, you want this man back in Tal Vahrar. He'll drive you mad. You may even have to appoint some sort of nurse or minder for him, and you'll definitely have to hide him from the Artificers. But the things he can do could make it worthwhile 100 times over. He's the best lockbreaker I've ever seen. He just needs to believe that I truly represent you."
"What do you suggest?"
"You have a wax sigil on your ledgers and letters of credit.
I've seen it, making my deposits. Put your seal on a sheet of parchment.
And incriminate myself, said Requin. No.
Already thought about that, said Locke. Don't write a name on it. Don't date it. Don't sign it to anyone. Don't even add your usual R. Just write something pleasant and totally non-specific. Look forward to comfort and hospitality, or expect every due consideration.
Trite bullshit. I see, said Requin.
He removed a sheet of parchment from a desk drawer, touched a quill to ink, and scrawled a few sentences. After sprinkling the letter with alchemical desiccant, he looked back at Locke.
And this childish device will be sufficient?
As far as his fears are concerned, said Locke, Callus is a child. He'll grab at this like a baby grabbing for a tit.
Or a grown man,
muttered Selendry. Requin smiled. Gloved as always, he removed the glass cylinder from a small lamp atop his desk, revealing a candle at its heart. With this, he heated a stick of black wax, which he allowed to drip into a pool on the sheet of parchment. At last, he withdrew a heavy signet ring from a jacket pocket and pressed it into the wax.
Your bait, Master Costa.
He passed the sheet over.
The fact that you're skulking at the service entrance and trying to hide beneath that cloak both suggest you're not planning on staying in the city for long.
Back south in a day or two, as soon as my shipmates finish offloading the, completely legitimate and responsibly acquired cargo we picked up in Port Prodigal. That was a safe lie. With dozens of ships offloading in the city every day, at least a few of them had to be carrying goods from criminal sources.
And you'll bring Callus back with you?
Yes.
If the sigil isn't sufficient, promise him anything else reasonable. Coin, drugs, drink, women, men, both. And if that's not enough, take Selendry's suggestion and let me worry about his state of mind. Don't come back empty-handed.
As you wish.
What then for you and the Archon? With Callus in hand, you'll likely be back to this scheme for my vault.
I don't know, said Locke. I'll be at least 6 or 7 weeks away before I can come back with him. Why don't you ponder how I can best serve you in that time? Whatever plan you deem suitable. If you want me to turn him over to the Archon as a double agent, fine. If you want me to tell the Archon that he died or something, I just don't know. My skull aches. You're the man with the big picture. I'll look forward to new orders.
If you can stay this polite, said Requin, hefting the purse, bring me Callus and continue to be so satisfied with your place in the scheme of things, you may well have a future in my service.
I appreciate that.
Go. Selendry will show you out. I still have a busy night lying in wait for me.
Locke let a bit of his actual relief show in his expression. This web of lies was growing so convoluted, so branching, and so delicate that a moth's fart might knock it to pieces. But the two meetings of the night had bought what he and Jean needed. Another 2 months of life from Stragos, and another 2 months of tolerance from Requin. All they needed to do now was steal back to their boat without complication and row themselves to safety. 13. We're being followed, said Jean as they crossed the Sinspire service courtyard. They were headed back toward the maze of alleys and hedgerows from which they'd come, the little used block of gardens and service paths behind the lesser chance houses. Their boat was tied up at a pier along the inner docks of the great gallery. They'd snuck up to the top of the golden steps on rickety stairs, ignoring the lift boxes and streets on which 1,000 complications might lurk. Where are they?
Across the street, watching this courtyard. They moved when we moved just now.
Shit, muttered Locke.
If only this city's entire population of lurking assholes shared one set of balls so I could kick it repeatedly.
At the edge of the courtyard, let's make a really obvious sudden dash for it, said Jean. Hide yourself. Whoever comes running after us gets to explain some things the hard way.
At the rear of the courtyard was a hedge twice Locke's height. An archway surrounded by empty crates and casks led to the dark and little-used backside of the golden steps. About 10 yards from this archway, acting in unison by some unspoken signal, Locke and Jean broke into a sprint. Through the arch, into the shadowed alley beyond, Locke knew they had just moments to hide themselves. They needed to be far enough from the courtyard to prevent any of the Sinspire attendants from glimpsing a scuffle. Past the backs of gardens and walled lawns they ran, scant yards from buildings where hundreds of the richest people in the Therin world were losing money for fun. At last they found two stacks of empty casks on either side of the alley, the most obvious ambush spot possible, but if their opponents thought they were hell-bent on escape, they might just ignore the possibility. Jean had already vanished into his place. Locke pulled his boot dagger, feeling the hammer of his own heartbeat, and crouched behind the casks on his side of the alley. He threw his cloaked arm across his face, leaving only his eyes and forehead exposed. The rapid slap of leather on stones, and then two dark shapes flew past the piles of casks. Locke deliberately delayed his own movement half a heartbeat, allowing Jean to strike first. When the pursuer closest to Locke turned, startled by the sound of Jean's attack on his companion, Locke slipped forward, dagger out, filled with grim elation at the thought of finally getting some answers to this business. His grab for the attacker was good. He slipped his left arm around the man's neck at the exact instant he shoved his blade up against the soft junction of neck and chin on the other side. "Drop your weapon, or I'll..." was all he had time to say, however, before the man did the absolute worst thing possible. He jerked forward in an attempt to break Locke's hold, perhaps reflexively, not realizing the angle at which Locke's blade was poised. Whether it was supreme optimism or miserable foolishness, Locke would never know, as the man sliced half the contents of his neck open and died that instant, spewing blood. A weapon clattered to the stones from his limp fingers. Locke put his hands up in disbelief and let the corpse drop, only to find himself facing Jean, who was breathing heavily over the unmoving form of his own opponent. "Wait a minute," said Locke. "You mean..." "Accident," said Jean. "I caught his knife, we fought a bit, and he got it beneath his own ribcage." "God damn it," Locke muttered, flicking blood from his right hand. "You try to keep a bastard alive, and look what happens." "Crossbows," said Jean. He pointed to the ground, where Locke's adjusting eyes could see the dim shapes of two small hand crossbows. "Alley pieces, the sort of thing you used within 10 yards or not at all. Grab them. There may be more of them after us." "Hell!" Locke grabbed one of the bows and gingerly handed the other to Jean. The little quarrels might be poisoned. The thought of handling someone else's envenomed weapon in the dark made his skin crawl. But Jean was right. They'd need the advantage if they had other pursuers. "I say discretion is a pastime for other people," said Locke. "Let's run our asses off." They sprinted at a wild tear through the forgotten places of the Golden Steps, north to the edge of the vast Elderglass Plateau, where they scrambled down flight after flight of nauseatingly wobbly wooden steps, glancing frantically above and below for pursuit or ambush. The world was a dizzy whirl around Locke by the middle of the staircase, painted in the surreal colours of fire and alien glass. Out on the harbour, the fourth and final ship of the festival was bursting into incandescence, a sacrifice of wood and pitch and canvas before hundreds of small boats packed with priests and revellers. Down to the feet of the stairs and across the wooden platforms of the inner docks they stumbled, past the occasional drunkard or beggar, waving their daggers and crossbows wildly. Before them was their pier, long and empty, home only to a long stack of crates. No beggars, no drunks. Their boat bobbed welcomingly on the waves, just 100 feet away now, brightly lit by the glare of the inferno.
Stack of crates, Locke thought, and by then it was too late. Two men stepped from the shadows as Locke and Jean passed from the most obvious ambush spot possible. Locke and Jean whirled together. Only the fact that they were carrying their stolen crossbows in their hands gave them any chance to bring them up in time. Four arms flew out. Four men standing close enough to hold hands drew on their targets. Four fingers quivered, each separated from their triggers by no more than the width of a single droplet of sweat. Locke Lamora stood on the pier in Tal Varar with the hot wind of a burning ship at his back and the cold bite of a loaded crossbow's bolt at his neck. 14. He grinned, gasping for breath, and concentrated on holding his own crossbow level with the left eye of his opponent. They were close enough that they would catch most of one another's blood should they both twitch their fingers at the same time.
"Be reasonable," said the man facing him. Beads of sweat left visible trails as they slid down his grime-covered cheeks and forehead. "Consider the disadvantages of your situation."
Locke snorted. "Unless your eyeballs are made of iron, the disadvantage is mutual. Wouldn't you say so, Jean?" Jean and his foe were toe to toe with their crossbows similarly poised. Not one of them could miss at this range, not if all the gods above or below the heavens willed it otherwise.
"All four of us would seem to be up to our balls in quicksand," said Jean between breaths.
On the water behind them, the old galleon groaned and creaked as the roaring flames consumed it from the inside out. Night was made day for hundreds of yards around. The hull was crisscrossed with white-orange lines of seams coming apart. Smoke boiled out of those hellish cracks in little black eruptions, the last shuddering breaths of a vast wooden beast dying in agony. The four men stood on their pier, strangely alone in the midst of light and noise that was drawing the attention of the entire city. Nobody in the boats was paying any attention to them.
"Lower your piece, for the love of the gods," said Locke's opponent. "We've been instructed not to kill you if we don't have to."
"And I'm sure you'd be honest if it were otherwise, of course," said Locke. His smile grew. "I make it a point never to trust men with weapons at my windpipe. Sorry."
"Your hand will start to shake long before mine does."
"I'll rest the tip of my quarrel against your nose when I get tired. Who sent you after us? What are they paying you? We're not without funds. A happy arrangement could be reached."
"Actually," said Jean, "I know who sent them."
"What? Really?" Locke flicked a glance at Jean before locking eyes with his adversary once again.
"And an arrangement has been reached, but I wouldn't call it happy."
Jean, I'm afraid you've lost me."
"No."
Jean raised one hand, palm out, to the man opposite him. He then slowly, carefully shifted his aim to his left until his crossbow was pointing at Locke's head. The man he'd previously been threatening blinked in surprise.
"You've lost me, Locke."
"Jean," said Locke, the grin vanishing from his face, "this isn't funny."
"I agree. Hand your piece over to me."
"Jean!"
"Hand it over now, smartly. You there, are you some kind of moron? Get that thing out of my face and point it at him."
Jean's former opponent licked his lips nervously, but didn't move. Jean ground his teeth together.
"Look, you sponge-witted dock ape, I'm doing your job for you. Point your crossbow at my god's damned partner so we can get off this pier."
"Jean, I would describe this turn of events as less than helpful," said Locke, and he looked as though he might say more, except that Jean's opponent chose that moment to take Jean's advice. It seemed to Locke that sweat was now cascading down his face, as though his own treacherous moisture were abandoning the premises before anything worse happened.
"There. 3-1.
Jean spat on the pier.
You gave me no choice but to cut a deal with the employer of these gentlemen before we set out. God's damn it, you forced me. I'm sorry. I thought they'd make contact before they drew down on us. Now give your weapon over.
Jean, what the hell do you think you're...
Don't. Don't say another fucking thing. Don't try to finesse me. I know you too well to let you have your say. Silence, Locke. Finger off the trigger and hand it over.
Locke stared at the steel-tipped point of Jean's quarrel, his mouth open in disbelief. The world around him seemed to fade to that tiny gleaming point, alive with the orange reflection of the inferno blazing in the anchorage behind him. Jean would have given him a hand signal if he were lying. Where the hell was the hand signal?
I don't believe this, he whispered. This is impossible.
This is the last time I'm going to say this, Locke. Jean ground his teeth together and held his aim steady directly between Locke's eyes. Take your finger off the trigger and hand over your God's damned weapon. Right now!